if there is no proof, philosophical proof of the existence of God, then why should anyone believe? Right? That was the question we left off with, and we understand kofer. There's no proof, so they don't believe in something without proof. They don't believe in God, so there's no proof. But if there's no proof, so why should anyone be a believer? So here I want to explore a few different angles. One angle is very popular nowadays. It doesn't have great roots in the Rishonim. Has like hints here and there. And in someplace, or Sameach, there's a guy who like says the Sheet of the Kuzari, even though it's not really found in the Kuzari. But there is a historical proof. Some people want a Taina that there's no philosophical proof to God's existence, meaning from ideas, but there's a historical proof from facts, right? Philosophical proofs are like from abstract ideas. Historical proofs are... No, there's no abstract philosophical reason. It's just the facts happen to work out. And what's the... Everyone's familiar with this argument by now. What's the historical proof of the existence of God? Matan Torah, right? They find a few places in the Rishonim who sort of hint at this, but it's not found in the Rishonim, but the argument goes something like this. If an entire generation cannot convince their kids of something they didn't believe, because, like, how are they all going to get together and lie without it being totally given away and everyone laughing at them, etc.? Right? So the masses of people cannot pass on to the next generation something they don't honestly believe. Could be true, could be false, but they have to honestly believe it. Because if they all honestly thought it was false, how would they like get together and like make up the lie and no one would give it away and they would convince everyone? Like, masses and millions of people can't all get together and decide to lie. It's too hard to make that conspiracy. Okay. I mean, you have to go into details, but it's a reasonable svara. Therefore, if a whole community like believes something that their fathers told them that it was a Masorah, their fathers must have also believed it. Okay, so if their fathers believed it, then their fathers must have believed it. And if their fathers believed it, then their fathers must have believed it.
Yeah, plenty of myths which involve humans exist.
So hold on a second. And if their fathers believed it, then their fathers must have believed it. If their fathers believed it, then their fathers must have believed it. Okay, so why are all myths by definition true and all religions true and all contradictory beliefs, you know, that's ridiculous then. Not right. Everything believed by masses of people is true. It would just right. be in the devil's self. No, but that's only if there are masses of people. Take, for example, Christianity. Why do they believe, meaning, whether there was a guy named Jesus who preached inspiring nice ideas, maybe there was, but that's not the point, right? The point is that he was the Son of God. How did they know he was the Son of God?
Because he said so.
Yeah, but then all that proves right. is that he really said so, which doesn't prove anything. It's because he rose from the dead, right? And normal people can't rise from the dead. Okay, so that proves Son of God. Maybe something. It proves something worthy of being a religion, right? How do they know he rose from the dead? Because 12 people saw him rise from the dead. 12 people. So, it's honestly, masses of people believe that those 12 people said they saw him rise from the dead. But 12 people can make something up. Or could be fooled, or could, you know, whatever. 12 people can make something up. How do the Muslims know that Muhammad was correct? You know, everyone agrees Muhammad lived. Everyone agrees Muhammad preached. You know, that's recent enough in history that we have lots of evidence. But how do they know that he was the greatest prophet? How do they know he was a prophet?
He convinced them.
So he convinced them by his oratorical skills. Okay, but all that means is that he was a great preacher. He wrote a great book. Okay, but so did Shakespeare, right? Meaning, again, no one denies that Jesus, if he lived or someone like that lived, was a very talented fellow. The question is, was he the Son of God? No one denies that Muhammad, who definitely lived, was a very talented fellow. The question is, was he more than that? So how do they know? Because he went up to heaven, right? He miraculously flew up to heaven. Okay, how do they know he flew up to heaven? Because this Talmud saw him. And they all honestly believe that one person testified that. But the one person could be lying or could be deluding himself. Meaning, many myths are not based on the fact that masses of people witness something. They're based on the fact that one or a few people saw something, or one or a few people said something. So then we honestly believe that these masses of people heard it from one or a couple of people. But why would you trust that one person or those few people? What's unique about the story of Judaism is that the Masorah is that masses of people originally saw the revelation in Har Sinai. They didn't just hear from Moshe that he got a Torah from God, or that God existed. Meaning, if the Masorah had been that everyone heard that Moshe showed up one day and told everyone he spoke to God, then you would say that Masorah is true, but who says that Moshe fellow is telling the truth? But that's not the Masorah, is that everyone heard God speak. So, if so, then they couldn't have all gotten together and conspired about this, and they wouldn't have all lied about it. So I'm skipping the details, but that proves that it must be true. And there's no other good myth or religion that has the same properties. Okay, what did we just, let's bring everyone in. We asked, if there's no philosophical proof God exists, then why are there believers? So the first answer is there's no philosophical proof, but there's historical proof. What's the historical proof? Meaning there are lots of historical amazing things. That's not the same as a proof. The proof would be what they teach in Or Sameach based on Diyukim and the Kuzari, and they teach in a lot of places nowadays, which is not on the sheet, it doesn't actually have Makoros behind it until nowadays, is that it must be true because the masses and whole communities of people can't like all get together and make up a lie and get away with fooling the next generation. So any generation who believes that they were something they were told by the masses before them must have really heard it from the masses before them, and the masses before them must have really believed it. So that proves that the generation before me really believed it, and the generation before them really believed it, and the generation before them really believed it, and the generation before them really believed it. That's true of a lot of myths and religions, but a lot of those myths and religions go back to because one person told us, because 12 person told us, because two people witnessed it. Okay, but those people could just make up whatever they want. There's only one religion that says that because masses of people saw a revelation, and therefore those masses of people must really honestly believe they saw a revelation. Since it would be awfully hard to fool them all, they must have actually seen a revelation. And therefore, it's not really a proof of God directly. It's more a proof of Torah Sinai, right? If there's a Masorah that the masses of people saw God revealed at Har Sinai, they must have seen God revealed at Har Sinai. And obviously, that proves that God exists, together with the fact that the Torah is true. That is the classic historical proof that's offered nowadays in a lot of places. Says not a philosophical proof, but it's a historical proof. Yeah,
isn't a lot ascribed to Chizkiah Melech and Ezra?
So now you get a lot of details about this. Really, is it true there was always a mass Masorah of this? What happened in the days of Yoshiyahu, etc.? You know, is it really true that, you know, what if things got added to a little at a time? You know, I'm not convinced that this is a... I must admit, I'm not convinced this is an absolute truth. People debate it. Very, very smart people debate it. Ad hayom hazeh, they publish books one way, publish books the other way. Like, very serious people debate this proof. I don't mean only in, like, Kiryat Yeshivas and Discovery Seminar. I don't know if they did this on Discovery Seminar or whatever. Meaning, like, Goyish philosophers also are always, like, publishing essays in academic journals back and forth debating this proof. You know, this is, it's a very serious mitzvah in among religious philosophers. But there's a historical proof. I'm not necessarily convinced that, as you pointed out, it sounds like in some times Jewish history they didn't believe in the Torah. So maybe there isn't, maybe no one thought there was an unbroken chain of masses. Maybe it sounds like in some periods of time only Yechidim believed in the Torah. And then you get the problem that Yechidim could have made it up. Although, you know, you have to wonder. I mean, it's not so pushy historically.
Rabbi Kellerman, who I think started this, or came up with this theory, in a book, he says that even if Ezra wanted to make things up, the people of his generation knew what he was talking about. It wasn't a completely new thing he was giving to them.
Right. It's hard to make thing. It's hard to make anything up from scratch all of a sudden. Again, for individuals, it's possible. I can make something up from scratch for one person, for sure. But in the communal level, the national level, it is really hard to make things up from scratch. Okay, one could debate back and forth whether this is a good proof or not. I'm not convinced that it's a proof. We'll come back to it. But that's one derech, historical proof. Once it's historical proof, then you ask, well, if there's a good historical proof, how can there be kofrim? Then you have the same two choices. Either kofrim didn't learn well enough to understand the proof, or the kofrim are just biased and bribed by the Yetzirah. But I want to go to a different option, meaning there are those who really don't hold that emunah is based on proofs. Who doesn't hold emunah is based on proofs? Primarily Hasidim. Look at the Hasidim. Let's go to 13. What does the Rav Tzaddok say? V'hainu anochi. Anochi Hashem Elokecha, according to the Rambam, is the first of the 248 mitzvahs asay. What's grammatically problematic? Anochi Hashem Elokecha shows his sechem yisrael miyosavatir. What's the grammatical problem with counting that as a mitzvah?
It's no tzivoy.
It's no tzivoy. It's just a statement. It says Rav Tzaddok, v'hainu anochi v'loshon tzivoy. I'm reading Makor 13. Promotion is bar makam acher shum neged emunah pshuta. It's not a tzivo, it's for emunah pshuta. It's a chassidim believe in emunah pshuta, and everyone misunderstands emunah pshuta. Emunah pshuta means I have simple faith. Yes. Okay, but what's the basis of your simple faith? Why do you believe your simple faith? I just believe in my Masorah. But why do you believe in your Masorah? So what's the answer to that? The answer is, if I had a why, it wouldn't be simple faith. The whole point of simple faith is there is no why. It's just simple faith. And that's what he says. What does it mean? It's just there. It's kavua. It's just in the heart of a Jew. It's just there. It doesn't need a reason. There are many things we believe without a reason. Right? Why do I believe that I exist? Not really because of a reason. I just do. Why do I believe in space and time? Kant struggled with this a lot. I just do. There are certain things. Why do I breathe? I could give you all kinds of learned explanations as to why mammals need to breathe. And not only mammals. All animals need to breathe. But that's not why I breathe. I don't breathe for any reason. I just do. It's just natural. It says it's kavua. It's just there. I am Hashem. We believe in Hashem. Lo shechza tzivoy. You can't command someone to believe in God. Mishayim mamel lo yol tzivoy. If someone doesn't believe, you can't command them to believe. So why do Jews believe? Rak Yisrael b'mina b'nei maminim. We just believe. We just do. That's what emunah pshuta means. One says, but why do you have emunah pshuta? It's an invalid question. There is no why for emunah pshuta. That's what pshuta means. Jews just believe. Why? Because Yisrael b'mina b'nei maminim. We just do. It's just in our nature. I don't know. You know, why do Africans have black skin? For a reason? No. That's just part of who they are. You know? They just do. You know, why? It's not shy to ask for a reason. It's just part of their nature. And why did Jews believe? Because we're Maminim, they Maminim. It's just part of our nature. The Kedushas Levi in 14 says the same thing. Ki levavar nasos eschem ba'alokim. What does it mean? Nasos? Perush. Ki zesh amar kodesh baruch hu ba'atzma onochi lo yilecha. When Hashem himself said onochi lo yilecha, nirsham v'nechak leiv kol ish Yisrael. It was engraved and impressed on every Jewish heart. Meaning, something in Har Sinai just changed the nature of our souls and engraved upon that we believe. Even the least from Jews is Moser Nefesh for Kiddush Hashem. How do Jews pass every Nisayon? Because they just have belief in their hearts. Say the Hasidim, Jews believe just because they believe. That's it. It's just in their nature. They don't need a reason. It's just natural for a Jew to believe. Why do I believe? Just because I do. I don't ask why. It's like asking why I breathe. It's a weird question.
But didn't you, in effect, after saying, continuously, that you're not going to give a reason, didn't you technically give a reason? And that, meaning like, you say like it's impressed, you know. You're giving a reason, it's just not some complicated reason, but that's a reason. Then you could also even ask on that reason that you gave, well, why did that, I mean, why was it impressed?
There's a reason why God created and ran the world in such a way that he made Jews believe. But that's not the same as I have reason for believing. It's like breathing. There's a reason, if you would ask a scientist why I breathe, he would say, of course there's a reason you breathe, in nature and evolution and this and that and everything. But I don't have a reason why I breathe. So likewise, there is a reason behind why Jews believe in God's plan for the world. But the Jew doesn't have a reason for believing. It comes naturally. Everything comes naturally. There's a reason the world is created that way. But it's, I don't need a reason.
It's not saying that there is no reason. It's just saying that it's not privy to me.
Yeah, I don't need a reason. I don't need a reason. It's in my nature. A 15th Bnei Yisachar says, Rak Bnei Yisachar, sorry, Rak Ikar Avoda Mitzvah Yisrael, the Ikar Avoda for a Jew, Lahaslik Munim Kabbalah, Kabbalah meaning not what we call Kabbalah, but Masorah. To just believe in his Masorah. Ki Kenev Techonu Yotzreinu Ba'amur Le'el Avram Ki Yedatev Manashe Yitzavus Bona V'chulu Shomer Derech Hashem. Hashem promised Avram his kids to keep Derech Hashem. Uperish Yedatev. What does it mean, Yedatev? Nasat V'chinas Adas. Hashem gave to the seed of Avraham this Das. Three great words. I gave Avram knowledge that goes in his DNA. Jews have DNA. Everyone has DNA. Just like you could have DNA for skin color and for hair color and for whatever other traits. Jews have DNA of Emunah. How did we get Emunah? Yerusha? Beteva Memela. It's just, again, it's like asking someone why they have white skin. A scientist is looking for reasons, but I don't have a reason why my skin is white. That's just how I was born. That's just part of my nature, right? I don't have a reason why I breathe. It's just part of my nature. Why do I walk on two legs and not four? That's just how I'm built, right? So why does a Jew believe? Because a Jew believes. Vihine says that he concludes with Bnei Yisachar, Vihine Achakiris L'Shuvil Cherpa, who, if a Jew philosophizes, it's a cherpa. Because emuna is natural in anyone who descended from Avram. Whoever's not satisfied with his Masorah, wrote a lach b'chakiras and wants to philosophize to prove God's existence. It's as if he's admitting that he doesn't have yichus from Avram. Meaning, any Jew says, I want to prove God exists, because I don't just believe automatically, is almost like admitting that he's not really a Jew. That maybe he, like, I don't know, he got mixed up in the hospital. He doesn't have Jewish genes. Right? The Hasidim are very clear. Why do Jews believe? Again, Hasidus is generally more what they call essentialist nowadays. People have essential nature based on how they're born. A Jew believes because a Jew believes. It's just Beyerusha, Beteva, Mimela.
Even those like the Rambam and the Rasadigon who think that you should have a philosophical emunah, don't they still think that the base of it is emunah? In just because of the Masorah?
They believe that a person should believe in his Masorah before he philosophizes just to keep on the right path. But ultimately, you should just prove it philosophically. Like, that's a crutch. That's not the ideal. The ideal is to believe philosophically. And the Bnei Yisachar is saying, no, the ideal is to not believe philosophically. The Bnei Yisachar is another, the 16th says, Hinei var lecha iser, maybe we won't read the whole thing, but just a little. Hinei var lecha iser, kasav me'riach z'makam achim, u'shanach le'me Yisrael, am Hashem eile, zekol prima aseinu, we am Hashem, le'snaig be'emunah shor Yerushalanu v'teva kaim lanu, Bnei Yisrael. Right? Again, he says the same thing. We should follow Emunah, which is Yerusha, which is our teva, because we're Jews, davka, al piyator, v'chalila lachba, chalila to philosophize. Okay, hold on a second. If philosophy is so evil, and it's like, show me you're not a Jew, etc., what does he do with the Rishonim and Gaonim, right? So I think nowadays, they would just say, oh, they didn't really mean it. But in the Bnei Yisachar's days, they hadn't yet invented this idea that whenever Rishonim say something that is too modern, you say they never said it. So what does he say? He has a great answer, Hagah. Don't ask me kashrus, the kedoshim who are now in Gan Eden, in their books, or Sadigom, say from Udus Fachasad Akados, or Rina Bachi, say from Kosalvos, or Rambam. Don't ask me kashrus, all the people in the beginning of this Makorah sheet who held that you should philosophize. Kiyesh was that sod kamos. That was a secret why they did that. There was a secret reason they needed to philosophize just to keep their generation alive in the fifth millennium. Now, of course, we're in the sixth millennium, right? It's 5, 7 something, or in his days it was, you know, 5, 6 something. Shaya b'chinas choshech by Rasha. Of course the Rishonim and Gaonim philosophized. That was a secret Rasha based on the Kabbalistic nature of their millennium. Can't really argue with that, right? And like Avraham Avinu had to philosophize to show all the other people in the world the truth. b'mechkar anoshi through human logic. Kim shayah hador bechashkos, because they were the gedder of chashecha. Vinei bachar Hashem shol chelk of yomlos halach v'fanav ve'yitamim v'lo chakir zavim. And then Hashem chose Avram and says his halach v'fanav ve'yitamim, just have a muna tamima and stop doing that. Okay, so he says, okay, he has a explanation. All those Rishonim were a secret over Asha, but obviously, that if you do it nowadays when there's no secret over Asha, that would just be antithetical to Judaism in his conception. Okay, then he brings something very cute. I won't read it inside. He quotes in the Chassid Yabetz, meaning not Rav Yaakov Emden from the 1700s, but the Chassid Yabetz, who was from the generation of the expulsion from Spain, who points out that all the like Amoratzim and simple people of his days, when they said, convert to Christianity or die, were Moser Nefesh al Kiddush Hashem. And all the big philosophers converted to Christianity. It says, you think the opposite. All the philosophers have proofs for their emunah. They should never compromise. All the Amoratzim, they don't know anything they should compromise. It says, no, all the philosophers, they prove their emunah with philosophy. Philosophy is only so strong because it's just human logic. It's not as strong as the Inquisition. But the Amoratzim, they believe because of Hashem. They believe because of the inspiration of Hashem. And Hashem is infinite, and therefore they had infinite power, and therefore it's yet another proof that non-philosophical emunah is better than philosophical emunah. Okay, so here we have a clear explanation. Why should you believe if not for philosophical proof, maybe historical proof, which is another kind of proof and subject to the same analysis. Or the Hasidim say, you believe just because you believe. A Yid believes because a Yid believes. That's the nature of a Yid. Now if you ask the Hasidim, so why are there kofrim in the world? They'll have a very simple explanation. Who are kofrim? Goyim. Why are Goyim kofrim? Because Jews, their DNA, spiritual DNA, their teva is to believe. And Goyim's teva is to not believe. Because the Jews have a good teva, and the Goyim have an evil teva. So it's very simple. We have a Muna Pshuta, and they have Kira Pshuta. It's just in our teva to believe, to not believe. What's the one tricky part? How come there are
Jews that don't believe?
How come there are Jews who don't believe, according to the Hasidim? Right? Meaning if it's Birusha, Viteva, Mimela, I don't know, you ever meet people who don't breathe? Right? No, everyone breathes. Why? Because it's like Viteva, Mimela. It's not something you decide to do. Some people, I don't know, other things some people do, some people don't. But everyone breathes because it's Birusha, Viteva, right? Everyone walks on two legs because it's Birusha. It's Birusha, Viteva. So why are there Jews who don't believe? It's a good question, right?
Why is most of the non-Jewish world religious?
Why do they believe to a certain extent? Okay, you can answer. The truth is, I don't know. I mean, the Hasidim didn't deal with that so much, so I could speculate things. I could say, no, that's not really a belief. That's really a corrupted belief. It really just looks like a belief, but it's really rotten on the inside. Who knows? But they did deal with more. How come there are Jews who don't believe? Meaning, what if, you're like a Rosh Hashiva, and a Hasidish Yeshiva, and a Bacher comes to you and says he doesn't believe in God? So what would you do in a Litvish Yeshiva if the Bacher comes and says he doesn't believe in God?
Kick him out.
No, that's a Chinuchi question. There are some yeshivas that would kick people out, so that wouldn't. That's Chinuchi. That's not philosophical. That just depends how nice you are. But what would they do in a Litvish Yeshiva? What are they doing in a Litvish Yeshiva? They would sit, the Mashgiach would sit you down, and he would tell you, he would read you Rav Chanan and say, don't be biased by your taivas, try and think about it objectively, and let's show how there's really strong proofs, and you should really believe it. He would say, try to really think objectively and believe it, and he would try to give you intellectual reasons for believing. In the Hasidic Yeshiva, the last thing they would ever do is argue with you about why you should believe. Because there is no why you should believe, you just believe. So what's the Mashgiach going to tell you? So, we'll see them, of course, in a second, but I spoke to someone who learned in the Hasidic Yeshiva, and I asked him, what does the Mashgiach tell you? He says, it's Pashat. If a Bacher comes to the Mashgiach and it says, I don't believe in God, but the Mashgiach says, a Yid believes in God. His, the Shamash and the Satavi Tahora, he believes in God. A Goy doesn't believe in God. So, what Goyishness got into your soul that made you not believe in God? I mean, there's no reason. It's just there must be some goyishness in your soul. So, for example, what could be in your soul? He would tell the fellow, well, tell me, have you been looking at inappropriate things on the internet? That could put a tumah in your soul, which would change the sully the nature of your soul and make you kofar. Says, no. I says, okay, have you been eating goyish foods that could make goyishness in your soul that would make you not believe? Say, maybe, well, the Mashgiach would work on it until he discovered, you have these modern Orthodox cousins and you went to their house and they had Hershey's chocolate and you ate the Hershey's chocolate, right? What's wrong with Hershey's chocolate?
No,
right? It's chalav akum, right? Meaning, what's wrong with chalav akum? Don't be a litvak and tell me what's wrong with chalav akum is that in the old days, sometimes they used to milk donkeys and pigs and you're afraid that it might be like non-kosher milk and it's xera, and then Rav Moshe Feinstein says we don't have to worry about it nowadays. That's Rav Moshe Feinstein. It's not a chassid. A chassid knows what's wrong with chalav akum is, what do you mean? It's chalav of the akum. What? You're going to nurse from the Sitra Achra? Right? Like, obviously, what could be worse than chalav akum? Right? So I know a certain Rosh Yeshiva who, like, in his family, like, after Bar Mitzvah, they're makben a chalav akum. But beforehand, no, because really, it's just a chumran, the loki, etc. You talk to a chassid, they'll say, Adarabba, once you're 70, if you drink chalav akum, maybe it won't be the end of the world. But a little kid whose brain is still developing and who doesn't know what he's going to be like when he grows up, are you kidding? You're gonna have him have a nurse at the breast of the Sitra Achra, Chalav Akum, instead of from Kedusha? What do you think will happen to him when he grows up? He'll for sure go off the derech, right? Pashut, right? The worst thing is to give Chalav Akum to a six-month-old in his formula, because then he has no hope whatsoever, right? You're bringing up a goyish to start with. So Lemaisa, that's what I'll tell you in Hasidic Yeshiva. There's no point discussing intellectually. It's not an intellectual discussion. It's natural. What is in your nature? What tumah did you put in your nature that messed it up? If you look for a second at 17, in the Sefer Yisod Avoda says, Binyani ha'yira, sibosav ha'masabim also mo'ilis elav ha'miskatskos ha'munatamid ha'masigah. What helps you with yira? To be mechad in your emunah all the time. Masigah nosa, how do you get emunah? Etc. He gives a million ways. Value. They go del taras halev l'shmor something called dea rav Hashem etz minus. Right? How do you get chazkus and emuna? Keep your lay pure and save it from any hearing, any thinking about any evil opinions or any hint of heresy. The teich miyad she overs machshava midvar me'ila yashlichim daito miyad lo yisma mea b'chakiros. Right? It says, I'm a little tangent for my last point. It says, and how do you keep your emunah? If you ever have thoughts of doubt or anything, keep it out of your mind, kick it out of your mind right away, and don't think about it, right? Because it's not worthy of thought, right? Because you should just have the emunah pshuta, and you should just have tmimos, and you mechazik yourself, and just throw out any questions from your head. And how else do you get emunah? You keep the tar of your body from Averos. Don't let Averos metame your body. Especially in what you say, and in the issue of Zera Levatala, and from what you eat. Those are things that can make a pagam in your soul. Those will then make a pagam in your belief. And das, the root of emuna. Okay. What you get the point. He's saying, what causes, how do you keep your emunah pshuta? If you have any thoughts or questions, put them out of your mind right away, not worth thinking about, and just keep your soul pure for all the avirus that can put tumah in it. Right? Because kfirah comes from tumah in your soul, and if your soul is pure, you'll automatically believe. And that's the Hasidish approach, is that if you have any questions about emunah, you don't think about them and come up with answers. You just put them aside right away. Like, for example, look at number 18, the Shomer Aminim. You've heard of the Rav Arulah Hasidim? This is Rav Arulah. His sefer is called Shomer Aminim. There's an older book called Shomer Aminim. This is the modern Shomer Aminim, Shomer Aminim, we'd say. What's fascinating is that, I'm going to read you this line. And tell me if it would remind you of a line someone would say about something else. The ikar that a person gets a tremendous punishment, a tremendous onesh for having thoughts against the bad thoughts against the emunah, shemach shavas kfir hashom, thoughts of kfir, ikar shemasham achshav bekirbo. The ikar onesh is only if you let it sit inside your head. But osim is a asek hashom, and you make a big deal out of it. If you throw it out of your head right away, and you say it's disgusting, and you get rid of it right away, it doesn't have any effect on you. You get a big scar for refraining from it. Okay, fascinatingly, maybe you've heard someone say this line about what kind of thoughts? No, you never heard anything like this?
Hirhurim.
Hirhurim about? Hirhurim, right? What do people say? If a thought comes into your head and you push it off, that's los asuru, right? But if you keep it in your head and you think about it, that's an avira. Meaning, for a chassid, a machshavas kfira is the same as machshava varayos. Meaning, machshava varayos has intellectual value to it. It's like something we're thinking about. No, it's just like an improper thing that's not worth thinking about. It's the same thing. It's just an improper thing, not worth thinking. It's not a real question mark. It's not a real intellectual esek. You should not make an esek chas v'shalom out of it. And that's, I think, the general chassidish approach. There's nothing to discuss. There's nothing to talk about. Emuna pshuta. And if you have problems with emuna, then you don't discuss why they're wrong. You just discuss how to be metar yourself. And, you know, return to your state of emuna. So that's one competing theory to proof. There's proof emuna, and there is emuna pshuta. And the chassidim, like I pointed out, take it very seriously. The Rav... And Rav Lichtenstein, his famous article about this, short article about this that follows in the approach of his Rebbe, I think we've read all of the course, but we have to read 12 again, has a slightly different approach. Says the Rav, we read 12 already, but we'll just chazer it briefly. I intentionally use the term cosmic instead of cosmological. One may speak of the cosmic confrontation of man and God as an experiential reality. It's hard to speak of a cosmological experience. When God is apprehended, reality is an experience. When God is comprehended through reality, it's just intellectual performance. Intellectual proofs are just performance for him. The real way to find God is an experience. Experience for the Rebbe is real. Intellectual proofs are just a game. Second paragraph, he says, the trouble for all rational demonstrations... Yeah?
What's experiential? What does that mean?
Give me a second. The trouble for all rational demonstrations of the existence of God with which the history of philosophy abounds consists in their being exactly what they were meant to be by those who formulated them. Abstract, logical demonstrations divorced from the living, primal experiences in which these demonstrations are rooted. What's the Rav's problem with proofs of God? Not that they don't work. He doesn't care if they work. The problem with proofs of God is that... The problem with the intellectual philosophical proofs is that... Even if they work, they're intellectual philosophical proofs. They prove a cold intellectual abstract concept called God. That's not what the Rav's interested in proving. He doesn't want to believe in the intellectual abstract concept of God. He wants to have a relationship with a real God. And for the Rav, real means in my experience, not in my intellectual philosophical theories. That was the way the Rav looked at the world. Okay, there's many reasons we'll go into it, which go back to Kant and previously. But for the Rav, what you prove using abstract logical arguments is not really true. That's not the real reality. That's the game that philosophers play. Real reality is what you experience. That's why the Rav always talks about how you experience the world in all his books, right? How does the Lachman experience the world, etc. Lonely man of faith, how does he experience his faith? The Rav is not... You ready? He's writing the Lonely Man of Faith, Farishas Aleph, Farishas Beis. I'm not interested in arguing about biblical criticism, documentary hypothesis. That doesn't bother me. I'm interested in seeing what that tells us about how we experience God, right? And the Rav is many times not interested in proving God. Here's perhaps the most classic place. And then he says, for instance, the cosmic experience was transformed into cosmological proof, the ontic experience into an ontological proof, etc. He thinks religion started when people experienced God. Then someone made a mistake at some point and thought it could be improved if you turned those experiences into philosophical proofs, and they lost the whole point. Instead of stating that the most elementary existential awareness as a subjective I exists and objective the world around me exists, it's unattainable as long as the ultimate reality of God is not part of this awareness, the theologians engage in formal postulating and deducing in an experiential vacuum. Instead of feeling that my existence is totally on God and the world's existence is totally on God, they start turning into proofs and root everything. Because of this, they expose themselves to Hume's and Kant's biting criticism that logical categories are applicable only within the limits of the human scientific experience. Then he quotes the famous Kierkegaard line, does the loving bride in the embrace of her beloved ask for proof that he's alive and real? Must a prayerful soul clinging in passionate love and ecstasy to her beloved demonstrate that he exists? So has Soren Kierkegaard sarcastically been told that Anselm of Canterbury, the father of the very abstract and complex ontological proof, spent many days in prayer and supplication that he be presented with rational evidence of the existence of God. St. Anselm of Canterbury davened for days to have proof of God. And Kierkegaard makes fun of him. He says, you've been talking to him for days. Why do you need, like, what are you adding by proving? You're subtracting by proving. Right? If I need to prove my wife exists, that's not a shidruch. That's not an improvement in our marriage. That's a problem in our marriage. If something's real, you don't prove it exists. You only prove that, like, weird philosophical things exist. Like, real things are just there. They're in your life. You experience them. And that is what he says, just to finish, then I'll take Maimonides' term, Leda, transcends the bounds of the abstract logos, or pass over to the realm of the boundless, intimate, and passionate experience, etc. He says, the Rambam says, Leda Hashem, whether or not this shot in the Rambam, I said, is far from clear, or perhaps clear in the other direction. But the Rav's shot in the Rambam, it's shot in the Rav, when the Rambam says, Leda Hashem, he doesn't mean to know philosophical proofs. No, he throws those in as a side point, like for the cure of whatever, you know, for the cure of people, etc. He says Leda, he means to experience God. And you probably all read Rav Aaron's short article, right, the source of faith is? Faith itself. What does that mean, the source of faith? I mean, he discussed a few things there. He means that the source of faith is, how can the source of faith be faith itself? Meaning, the source of faith is my experience of God. I feel God's presence, I experience God's presence, and that's the source of my faith. And here he's following his Rebbe, and keep in mind, the Rav's, here's the important part, the Rav's saying the source is experience, right? You want another theory, one theory is intellectual proof, one theory is emunah pshuta, just the teva, mamela, natural for no reason, and what, meaning I don't have a reason, and the Rav's theory is from experience. The basis of faith is spiritual experience, is experience of God. That is why the Rav believes, because of his experiences of God.
Would it be completely ridiculous to say that maybe for these people who do philosophical proofs of this Anselm of Canterbury, that the advanced logical... whatever sort of doing that very complicated intellectual task was him sort of using his divine intellectual ability to sort of ruminate on ideas related to God, and the experience that he was connecting to God through was the intellectual.
No, I just think that in the Middle Ages, people had a different worldview than the Rav. In the Middle Ages, their worldview was what you experience is just how you feel today and just what you think you experience, and that's not trustworthy at all. Lots of people think they have all kinds of experiences. What's really true is what we can prove logically. That's how the whole Middle Ages thought. Everyone in the Middle Ages thought that way. Obviously, when I say everyone, I mean everyone in the mainstream philosophical tradition. That's a medieval way of thinking. And the Rav is I wouldn't say it's a postmodern way of thinking, but it's an existentialist way of thinking. The Rav's way of he just had a different way of thinking. He says, I experience God, but that's not true enough. I want real truth, and real truth you have to prove using logic. And the Rav says he's in a totally different philosophical milieu, which I can't explain now because I don't have enough time, and probably because I can't do a good enough job explaining it, based on my limited knowledge of philosophy. But we live in a different intellectual milieu. No one thinks that logic and philosophy can prove anything of substance. Everyone's given up on that by now in all worlds of philosophy. So what's real? For the Rav, what's real is my experience. That's real life. And it's just, they have a different idea of what's real. And that's where they're coming from.
It seems like he's done something with the Rambam, but there are plenty of other Rishonim that did believe in philosophy. Is he just saying that they're wrong, or it doesn't and work?
He only cares about the Rambam because, what's his last name? Soloveitchik, right? I mean, The Rav really, it doesn't matter the Rav first side, you go to agree with him or not. It only matters if the Rambam agrees with him. You know, that's a biographical, you know, observation, but it's true, right? Basically, the Rav always had the Rambam agree with him. That was his derech.
Okay.
So he couldn't disagree with the Rambam. Okay.
But I mean, whereas the Bnei Wait, what was the name of the
He said, oh, the Rambam's sword was a Harasha, etc. Yeah.
That's just the Rambam, all that he's shown him.
Yeah, but the Rav does can't say things like that. That's not his derech.
No, but he doesn't feel like an issue arguing with all that he's shown him.
Okay, here, I don't want to get into
the doesn't have to make Rav's up a reason like that, but...
When the Rav says something, the Rav says lines like, Judaism has always claimed that. And then finishes the sentence in a way that no one ever thought of before. Like, idea that no one ever thought of before. Now, between you and me, the Rav's right. But Judaism has always claimed that. He mumbles says Judaism has always claimed. Judaism has always claimed that that you can look at the world in one of two ways: fate or destiny. Where has Judaism always claimed that? Now it so happens I let the Rav get away with it because the Maisa he's right. Judaism should always have claimed that and always meant that on some deep level, just didn't realize it, right? But the Rav's derech was that he found the right philosophy and then assumed the Rambam agreed with him and Judaism always agreed with him, you know, and take his rebel course on the Mor Nevuchim. He took the Mor Nevuchim and turned it into a book that no one ever thought the Mor Nevuchim was until then. Maybe he's right. Okay, that's the Rav's derech. And it really, the Rav, it wouldn't bother the Rav, like for the Rav to say, and all Jewish philosophers got this wrong and didn't understand the Amkus of Chazal and Tanakh, doesn't bother him. Okay. But say that at the Rambam bothers him. That's why he has to rescue the Rambam. Okay, now, yeah.
You think it'd be best to try to combine all three
of them? Okay, so let me hold that thought for a moment. Let me just point out that what the Rav's trying to say here. So the Rav's being very clear, but a lot of people misunderstand it. Here's a fascinating question. What is the greater source of truth? Philosophical proof? Or no, philosophical proof is a bunch of logic games and you just basically do whatever you want. So what's the source of truth? Real life. Real life experience. And what would someone say back to the Rav? They would say back, yeah, but how do you know you really experienced God? Maybe you just think you did. And the Rav would answer back, what are you, Descartes' meditations? How does anyone know they ever experienced anything? Maybe they just think they did. How do I know that I'm standing here? How do I know that I'm talking to someone, etc.? Says like, okay, like, that's what it means to be a human being, that you have experiences and you live by your realities, your experiences. Otherwise, you're Rene Descartes' meditations on first philosophy and say, how do I know that I exist? How do I know there's a physical world? How do I know there are other people? Maybe I just think I experienced them. And here, I think, is the yesod of the Rav. The yesod of the Rav is that a lot of people misunderstand what the Rav and the Rambam are trying to say. They're like, well, he doesn't have a philosophical proof, so like Bidyevit, he'll say, oh, I believe in religion because of my experience. That's obviously not what the Rav is saying. The Rav is saying, no, l'chachila. I don't want a philosophical proof. Philosophical proofs are not worth very much. And if you think about it, how do human beings lead the non-religious part of their lives? Forget religion. How do human beings live? Do they live based on logic and philosophical proof or based on their experiences and their sort of deep intuitions about the nature of reality? So, what would you call someone who makes all their decisions in life based on logical philosophical proofs?
Philosopher.
I mean, more than a nerd. Like, they have psychological problems. I mean, like maybe Spock, right? Meaning, borderline autistic, really. That's not how anyone lives. When was the last time anyone decided anything important? Any secular person decided anything important based on logical proof? Like, what do we logically prove? A lot of things about math. Okay, that's not real life, with all due respect to mathematicians. You know, how do people know what's right and what's wrong? How do they know how to be what's ethical and what's unethical, what's moral and immoral? How do they know they should help people and not murder them? Is there a logical proof to that? No. There are certain things people know not with logical proof. They know with their souls, whatever you call it. There's certain knowledge which is not proven, which is experienced. How do people know what they want to what to do with their lives? How do people know who to marry? How do people know who their friends are? How do people know? Basically, almost every decision of any consequence that any human being ever makes is not based on philosophical proof. And here's where the Rav would say that you know, all these atheists are going to come and say, you shouldn't be religious. Religion is stupid because it's not proven. And, you know, that's a ridiculous criticism. Nothing of any significance whatsoever to human beings is proven. Human beings don't live by proof. Again, maybe whatever species Spock is from does. I don't know. I'm not a Bucky. The Rev watched a lot more Star Trek than I did. Allegedly. What?
He watched Star Trek?
That's what they say. I have no idea what that means. I have no idea what that means. But that's what people say.
Is it all of it or just the
show? No, just more than me, which is at least one episode. At least once, right? I don't know if it's true. But the point is that human beings, as human beings, make decisions based on their experiences, based on their deep-seated intuitions, based on their sensing certain truths in their souls, based on their experiences, and that's how all of life works. So the Rebbe is saying, because that's real, and religion should be. Not that religion is less real than all of life because it's not philosophically proven. Religion is as real as all other real things in life, if not more so, because it's not philosophically proven. And that is the Rav's basic mahalach. And I think it's definitely very attractive. Obviously, there's a certain existentialist element to this as well. What does existentialism mean? It generally means the idea of existentialism is you don't discover reality, you create reality with your actions and decisions. What's the existentialist element here? The leap of faith, Kierkegaardian leap of faith, meaning how do you know when to commit yourself to your experiences and when not to? There are lots of things that we don't commit ourselves to, and lots of things we do commit ourselves to in life outside of religion. How do you know whether to commit yourself to these experiences or whether to question the experiences? Because you always question experiences. How do I know it's a real experience? Maybe it's just something I feel. Maybe it's just this influence. Maybe it's just that. Maybe who knows, right? And that's where I think the Rav, I don't have anything written by the Rav about this. At a certain point, one has to make a leap of faith. What's a leap of faith? Leap of faith doesn't mean I'll just believe some random thing. That's silly. Why would anyone make that leap? Leap of faith means that I will take something which I feel on a very deep level, and instead of saying, sure, I'll be committed to it. I think every religious person has to take that leap of faith at a certain point. But it's not the leap of faith that's ikar. It's not that you find God because you decide to. No. You find God in your real life experience. You might need a leap of faith just to decide whether you're going to, you know, whether to be serious about it or whether to just, you know, ignore it. Because you can always choose which things to ignore and say maybe, maybe not, who knows, and which things to take seriously. And this is something you should take seriously. And then the Rav Ebenezer answer, why are they kofrim? Maybe they're kofrim because they were not zochet to experience what I experienced. And if they didn't experience that, then... And it's not something I could just like write in a piece of paper and prove to them. Right? They're kofrim because they did not have the experiences I have. And it's the experiences that teach you the truth about reality. What did the Rav always try to do? He always tried to share experiences with people, right? He always talked about sharing his experiences and how he didn't feel he was so successful, perhaps, because he just shared them by talking about them. And so that's the limit. But I think that really is a Yisod question.
Back to the point about, you know, you don't really make any decisions based on whatever, right?
Do you?
What?
Make decisions based on proof?
I'm not going to answer that.
Okay, great.
But let's just say that you hold that the brain is basically just a big computer. So then, just hypothetical. Like, then theoretically, all of those intuitions and deep understandings, whatever, are really just logical processes that your computer brain is carrying out that you just aren't privy to the steps that went into it. And that every single time you're doing philosophy, you're giving potential theories to how the computer did it. Right, which is why maybe it's even useful to do it, because you better understand the program that ran the whole thing. And really everything is governed by logic, and you do really do things
that way. Yeah, that's making a lot of assumptions. Meaning, I think if you would ask a scientist... If you would ask a scientist about the brain as a computer, they wouldn't say it's run by logic. Well, they'd say, no, it's a computer that doesn't work by logic.
The way neuroscientists study right, how the brain behaves, they use a lot of the same...
I don't think they use philosophical logic. I'm not convinced of that.
I think they use, like...
Yeah, maybe.
Kind of computer. I mean, each neuron is, like...
Right.
Kind of
yeah, so, thing. Okay, so the answer is, that's a tricky one. I don't, you know, no one has, no one actually, like, has worked it all out, right? Meaning, it's a theory. No one actually knows how we come to our decisions in our brains with our brain as a computer.
Like, it's a big mess of electrical...
Right, so I don't know the answer, meaning maybe, you know, ultimately you'll end up with a chassid. Okay, it's just natural in your brain. Maybe it depends on your DNA, maybe it's only natural in Jews' brains, who knows. I think the rabbi would say, I don't care. Meaning, I don't care how the brain works. Once you're asking how your brain works, then you're also like, meaning, if someone goes around asking how their brain works and the neurons and the computer in real life, there's also something very peculiar about that person. If someone works in a lab, that's a different story in their day job. But if the guy comes home and still keeps thinking about that, then he has problems. Or he will have problems in the end. So it's a good question, but Lemaisa, I don't know what the Rebbe would have said something very intelligent about it, but I don't know exactly what, but it didn't bother him. Okay, let me just summarize one second, come back to what you said a moment ago, and then I'll take a question. Right, we had basically a bunch of theories as to where Emunah comes from. Could be philosophical proof, challenges, why are there kofrim? Could be historical proof, challenge, why are there kofrim? And the answer might be because the proofs are not 100%. Could be just the Emunah Peshuta, then we understand why there are kofrim, where Emunah and Kfir comes from, the Tum and Tahor of the soul, the nature of the soul, or it could be the Rav, from experience. And maybe Emunah comes from certain experience, and maybe that's what Masorah is about, passing on experiences, giving people access to experiences, and people who haven't had experiences. It's true, it's interesting, in the world of Kirov, what do? They expose people to experiences of Ruchnias, and people become more from, right? I asked a guy once in Eishat Torah Discovery Seminar, I say, do people really become from because you prove to them that, like, Judaism is true in Discovery Seminar? He's like, no one ever becomes from because you prove something to them. That's not how people work. It's like how computers work. No, the point of proving Judaism to people in Discovery Seminar is it gets them, like, thinking enough that they'll say, boy, I should look into this more. And then they'll, like, come to yeshiva or whatever. And then they'll, like, experience, like, what Judaism is really all about. And then they'll become from. So it's interesting. Like I said, no one actually comes from because you prove anything. That's just a hook to get them in the door. They really become from because of the experiences they have, which is very fascinating. I'll just end with one point, which is, could it be that there's some combination here? Meaning, experiences, like, as much as we all, like, no one philosophically proves anything, but a prudent person is always a little wary of how he feels and what he intuits in his experiences, because he could be making a mistake, perhaps a very big mistake. And what do prudent people do? They try to think about whether things are logical, not proven. They don't prove things unless they're dealing with math. But they think about whether things make sense logically in addition to, you know, how they feel in their soul. And that seems like a sound strategy. And here you get into the fascinating question of, I remember when I didn't know an entire branch of philosophy, for some reason I thought that like the way philosophy works is, and the way it did work once upon a time, I know I thought that, once upon a time is how it works. How does it work? You either prove things or you don't prove them. You can either prove something's true or prove it's false, or you don't have proof and you don't know. Right? Doesn't sound like from Aristotle or something like this how philosophy should work. And you think scientists must be really good at that because they're always trying to prove things. And then you ask actual scientists, so is this theory proven, disproven, or do we not know? And he's like, that's a stupid way to think about it. No scientists think that way. You don't like prove or disprove or not know. You add evidence. Some things have a lot of evidence. They're not proven, could be wrong, but they have a lot of evidence. Some things have very little evidence. Some things have some evidence against. But in philosophy of science, and I tried learning philosophy of science, because it's very hard to imagine, what does it philosophically mean that this theory is more likely to be correct than the other theory? It still could be or could not be correct. That ties into the question of what does it mean that there's a 80% chance it'll rain tomorrow? It might rain, it might not rain. Either way, the prediction is true. What does it mean there's an 80% chance of rain? Philosophers struggle mightily with that. You know, it really hurts my brain. I almost failed that class. These are hard. we're not sure, like, in classic philosophical terminology, how to understand this. But it's true anyway. Like, we all know real scientists, what do? They say, we try to collect evidence and see how much evidence we have in every theory, like however much evidence there is. No, that's how seriously we take it. It's not a matter of, like, classic, like, you work out the symbolic logic and it comes out proven or not. No, you have, like, evidence for things. And that's, you know, if you think about it, so should we believe in God, should we not believe in God? There may be things that are evidence, and not only God. Let's expand the discussion a little. How about a specific religion involving God, such as Judaism, for example? You know, you're not going to prove or disprove things, because what does proof mean? There's no way out of the proof. There's always a way out of everything nowadays. Philosophy is very clever nowadays. Everyone's clever enough to get out of anything. But is there evidence for something or not? And here you might say, is there evidence for God? You know, like, are there amazing things about how the world works that we don't really have a full mathematical, scientific explanation why it works out that well? Even though you could say whatever you want, and it's not a proof. Like, yes, there are amazing things. Back to the historical proof. Are there amazing things about Jewish history which are strikingly different than many other histories? Which don't prove anything. You can always get out of it. Proof means there's no other explanation. There's always another explanation. But the question, add the evidence. Like, it is true that the Jewish Masorah is a uniquely strong Masorah, which makes uniquely strong claims. That doesn't prove anything, but it's more evidence than other competing Masorahs. Is there evidence from just the history of the world? Like, the history of the Jewish people, right? Many people who look at the history of the world and study Jewish history. Does Jewish history prove? I mean, Jewish history is remarkable, right? It's actually ludicrous. Like, if you had come to me thousands of years ago and predicted Jewish history, I would have said, that's the craziest thing I ever heard in my life. That is utterly ridiculous. What have you been smoking? Right? No one would have guessed in a gazillion years. Yeah, the Jews would still be around, and, like, for sure, like, the last 71 and a half years, et cetera, in the state of Israel. Like, who would have predicted this? Who would have predicted, like, open up the Tanakh, read about all these nations that, like, the only one who's still around is the Jews, you know, who were, like, the little guy who was... I mean, Tanakh makes Jews seem very important, and I think that's true spiritually. But if you actually look at the history of the Middle East, like, we're some, like, tiny tribe. I mean, look who we've been compared to. Egypt, you know? How big is Egypt? How big is Israel? You know, not to mention the fact that, like, we never lived in all of Israel because there are too many Plishtim who were actually strong, who were, like, real empires, you know, real nations, etc. You know, we're like a nobody of a nobody. And who that nobody of a nobody ended up, you know, being the only one who's still around. And not only that, like, we're over the world actually believe some form of their belief. Right? Now there's a lot of secularism in Europe, etc. You know, but most of the world is still from and actually believes, like, some book based on our Bible, based on the Torah, right? They actually do believe in the Torah. They just have additional things they believe, which are not quite in accordance with all of our Ikari Emuna. But it's like, it's totally ludicrous that the Jews are around. Does that prove anything? Of course it doesn't prove anything. You know, maybe we just have, like, really good DNA and we're smarter than everyone else. You know, and whoever's smarter than anyone else is going to have, you know, what did I just, okay. My daughter listens to this really snarky, clever fan fiction thing of Harry Potter. And they have this line about, like, who was at the top of the class. So, if you know a little, do people still know about Harry Potter nowadays? Right? Hermione and, what did they say? I don't know which characters it's based on. The only ones who got good grades are, like, Hermione and, like, some kid who was brought up in a non-English-speaking culture where they actually thought you should teach your kids to work hard, and someone else from some unnamed ethnic group, which is like 0.02% of the world but has 25% of the Nobel Prizes. It was a cute line. The snarky part was about the, you know, Indian kid whose parents actually teach them you have to work. But the not American Indian. There's remarkable things. Now, it doesn't prove anything, But, like, if you look at history and you look at the world and you look at all these proofs, like, everything is evidence. There actually is a lot of good evidence for many of these things. It's not a proof. But I do think the real answer is some combination. I think an intelligent person has to have evidence and weigh, not logical proof or disproof. That's outdated. But is there evidence for what he believes? Not overwhelming evidence that's going to prove something beyond a shadow of a doubt. That's not how things work in philosophy nowadays. And I think someone might say, let me look at all these proofs. There is evidence for religious belief. It's not a proof, it's evidence. And the evidence will make me comfortable with really committing myself to my experience, with believing in them, with taking them seriously. And I think a believing person nowadays generally would say, like, you know, am I believing something which is totally ludicrous and impossible, you know, and just a cult? Or am I believing something which there is evidence for, which you could debate back and forth for all eternity? But it's like, it's a good theory, which might or may not be true in terms of philosophical proof, but it's a good theory. It has some sound evidence behind it, although one could always explain it any way you want. And are there real-life experiences and deep-seated intuitions of the soul that say this is real to me? Yes, it's real to me. And if it's real to me, and I'm comfortable that with the evidence, then what's left is what the Rebbe doesn't talk about, but Kierkegaard does, the idea of leap of faith. Again, leap of faith doesn't mean I'm leaping into something which I don't have. It just means, like, leaping into taking something seriously and being committed to it, as opposed to just fooling around. Or as opposed to just saying, oh, I'll think about it and think about it and think about it and maybe and who knows, and I'll just put it on my list of things that who knows. But to take it seriously and with commitment, and I think that's where you really get faith. So I think the Rebbe is right. You probably have to add maybe a little more evidence than he himself would have added, because he really was Mavaza evidence, meaning maybe to an extreme. Or maybe not. Maybe he would agree. But I do think that ultimately the Rebbe is right, that nowadays it's not the philosophical proof. Right? There was a fellow who mentioned Rabbi Kellerman. Right? What's his book called?
The video on YouTube is irrational.
Okay, his book called Permission to Believe. What is permission to believe? Is they say, we believe because of something deep in our experience and our...
Pastor?
What?
I thought he's like a Baptist.
No, maybe there's someone else who's a Baptist pastor who holds similar things. He's a rabbi.
Maybe, isn't it? Or maybe it's... If you turn it over, it says like the Episcopal Church. Or
no, there must be... There could be two books by the same title. Anyway, he's like a firm guy. Anyway, and he said, like, I'm not going to prove belief to anyone. But, like, lest you think that belief is something which is disproven and which has, like, no evidence for it whatsoever, let me give you some philosophical arguments, which are just arguments and evidence. They're not proof. No one's going to prove anything if you don't want them to prove it to you. You can't prove anything nowadays in philosophy. But let me give you some arguments, which then give you permission to believe, which then, you know, make it a respectable amount of evidence that then it's a reasonable thing to believe. And if you really do believe it in your soul, then you should feel like you now have intellectual permission to take that seriously. And I think it's a good insight. And I think the Rav might not disagree. Okay, there's always more to analyze and more questions to ask, et cetera, and more answers that I might know or someone smarter than me might know, et cetera. But I will let us go now. And anyone who has questions can stay and ask questions.
Yeah, Kellerman, I haven't read the book. I only had that one.